From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
They've said the title is provocative, and I accept that categorization, but I don't consider the word provocative to be a negative description, because it's designed to provoke discussion and analysis and debate in a country where debate and discussion is almost completely absent.
Former President Jimmy Carter on his new controversial book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Today, a debate with two leading scholars, Norman Finkelstein of DePaul University and Gil Troy of McGill. But first, it's a January heat wave. As temperatures this weekend reach record highs across the Northeast, we'll look at global warming with Greenpeace Executive Director John Passacatano. All the more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The new U.S. operational commander in Iraq said Sunday it'll take two or three more years for American forces to gain the upper hand in the war, even if President Bush sends in more troops. Lieutenant General Raymond Odierno's comments come just days before the president's planning to announce a new escalation of the war. The president's expected to give a primetime speech Wednesday night and call for 20,000 more troops in the creation of a billion-dollar Iraqi jobs program run by the U.S. Army. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid have written to the president opposing the deployment of more troops, adding combat troops they argued would only endanger more Americans and stretch the nation's military to the breaking point for no strategic gain. On Sunday, Pelosi said Congress would not give the president a blank check, and that he would have to justify the sending of extra troops to Iraq. Democratic Senator Joseph Biden also criticized President Bush's plans for more troops.
The question is, do we continue with a policy that is failing? We've tried this policy twice in the last 12 months, surging troops into Baghdad. Unfortunately, my friends have got this backwards. We need a political solution before you can get a military solution. What has changed from 3 years ago when I sat in this program with you and said we need to surge 60,000 troops then is we now have a civil war.
Biden was speaking on NBC's Meet the Press. During the interview, he also announced plans to run for president. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham also appeared on the broadcast and defended the president's policy.
We are not winning, and if you're not winning, you're losing. And now's the time to come up with a strategy to win. The reason President Bush is going to do this because he understands that we have to win in Iraq. We cannot let this country go into the abyss. Now is the last chance and the only chance we have left to get this right.
New data from the Iraqi Health Ministry shows more than 17,000 Iraqi civilians and police officers died violently in the latter half of 2006. That's more than three times the number of Iraqis reported to be killed during the first 6 months of the year. A Health Ministry official provided the data to the Washington Post. The actual number of violent deaths in 2006 is believed to be higher because the official said these numbers were incomplete. The Independent of London is reporting the Iraqi government is drafting a new law that would give big oil companies such as BP, Shell, and ExxonMobil 30-year contracts to extract Iraqi crude. The law is expected to come before the Iraqi parliament within days. Foreign oil companies would be allowed to take up to 75% of the profits until they've recouped initial drilling costs. After that, they would collect about 20% of all profits. That's about twice the industry average for such deals. The oil law would allow the first large-scale operation of foreign oil interests in the country since the industry was nationalized in 1972. More information has come to light about the U.S. massacre in the Iraqi town of Haditha in 2005. The Washington Post has obtained an internal military report and photographs that show U.S. Marines gunned down five unarmed Iraqis who stumbled onto the scene of a roadside bombing in Haditha. The squad's leader, Staff Sergeant Frank Wuterich, shot the men one by one after Marines ordered them out of a white taxi in the moments following the explosion. Another Marine fired rounds into their bodies as they lay on the ground. The shootings were the first in a series of violent reactions by Marines on the morning of November 19, 2005. By the end of the day, 24 civilians had died, many of them women and children. The Iraqi government has announced plans to proceed with the execution of two of Saddam Hussein's co-defendants despite international criticism over the hanging of Saddam Hussein. The New York Times reports on the streets of the Arab world, the former Iraqi president has undergone a resurgence of admiration and awe over the past week. Meanwhile, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said Saturday his government might cut off diplomatic relations with countries that criticize Hussein's execution. If Maliki goes ahead with his threat, one of those countries affected could be Britain. On Saturday, British Foreign Secretary Gordon Brown said this about the execution.
Now that we know the full picture of what happened, I think we can sum this up as a deplorable set of events. It is something, of course, of which the Iraqi government has now expressed its anxiety and its shame at.
Gordon Brown has been tipped to succeed Tony Blair as British Prime Minister. Israel's drawn up secret plans to destroy Iran's uranium enrichment facilities with tactical nuclear weapons, this according to the Times of London. The paper's reporting two Israeli Air Force squadrons are training to blow up an Iranian facility using low-yield nuclear bunker busters. The attack would be the first with nuclear weapons since 1945, when the United States dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Israeli weapons would each have a force equivalent to 1/15 of the Hiroshima bomb. The Israeli Foreign Ministry denied the report. On Friday, President Bush nominated Vice Admiral Mike McConnell to replace John Negroponte as the Director of National Intelligence. Mike McConnell said he would work to increase the coordination between the nation's 16 different spy agencies.
I plan to continue the strong emphasis on integration of the community to better serve all of our customers. That will mean better sharing of information, increased focus on customer needs and service, improved security processes, and deeper penetration of our targets to provide the needed information for tactical, operational, and strategic decision-making.
Mike McConnell is a former director of the National Security Agency and the current director of defense programs at Booz Allen, one of the nation's biggest defense and intelligence contractors. Salon.com is reporting. Under McConnell's watch, Booz Allen has been deeply involved in some of the most controversial counterterrorism programs run by the Bush administration, including the infamous Total Information Awareness data mining scheme. Salon reports Booz Allen is likely participating in the agency's warrantless surveillance of the telephone calls and emails of American citizens. Mike McConnell's predecessor, John Negroponte, is moving to the State Department to be Condoleezza Rice's deputy. John Negroponte spoke Friday.
It's been a great honor, Mr. President, to serve as your first Director of National Intelligence. I will always be grateful to you for having given me the opportunity to help achieve the goals that you and the Congress set for intelligence reform. During the past 20 months, I believe that our intelligence community has embraced the challenge of functioning as a single, unified enterprise and reaffirmed the fact that it is the best intelligence community in the world, second to none.
A prominent Muslim leader from Ohio was deported last week by the U.S. government and hasn't been heard from since. Fawaz Damra was the former imam at Ohio's largest mosque, the Islamic Center of Cleveland. In 2004, he was jailed for allegedly concealing ties to the Palestinian group Islamic Jihad. The U.S. government says he was deported Thursday morning to the West Bank, but his family and friends say no one's heard from him since he was taken. Palestinian officials have said they don't know where he is. Damra's attorney also criticized the U.S. for giving no notice prior to the deportation. Damra was not given a chance to say goodbye to his wife or his three daughters who were born in the United States. In Gaza, the kidnapped Peruvian journalist Jaime Rezuri has been released nearly a week after being seized by gunmen. The 50-year-old Rezuri was on assignment for Agence France-Presse. He was set free on Sunday.
That's what I can say. It's too much for me to have more words than this right now, as you could understand. So just to say that I'm very happy to be released by the action they have took. So that's all. Thank you very much to all of you to take care of what was going on with me all these days.
No group has taken responsibility for the kidnapping. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the body of an Associated Press employee was found Friday with a gunshot to the back of his head. The 28-year-old man, Ahmed Hadi Naji, had gone missing on December 30th. He's the fourth AP staffer to die violently in the Iraq War. He worked as a messenger and occasional cameraman. A delegation of human rights activists arrived in Cuba to protest outside the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo. Protesters include Cindy Sheehan and Code Pink founder Medea Benjamin. She spoke in Havana.
We see that there are still close to 400 people in Guantanamo Bay, and they don't have access to due process by the law. And we know of all the abuses that have taken place there. We are part of an international group which is asking that the prison be closed.
The U.S. activists plan to march to the prison along with a former detainee and the mother of a man being held. Thursday marks the fifth anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo. Protests are scheduled around the world to call for the prison's closing. And in San Francisco, about 1,200 peace activists gathered on the beach Saturday to spell out the word impeach in giant letters visible from the sky. The protest occurred in the district of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Advocates of impeaching President Bush have criticized the House Speaker for saying impeachment is off the table. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Temperatures this weekend reach record highs across the Northeast, climbing to 72 degrees in New York and New Jersey, hitting almost 70 in Boston and Connecticut. Britain's Meteorological Office predicted 2007 is likely to be the hottest year since record-keeping began in the mid-1800s. The organization cited rising temperatures due to global warming from greenhouse gases and human activity, combined with the naturally occurring El Niño, as likely to break the Earth's temperature record this year. The world's 10 warmest years have all occurred since 1994, with 2006 the sixth warmest on record. Just recently, the Bush administration, under the threat of a lawsuit, agreed to declare polar bears an endangered species. The bear's Arctic habitat has experienced declining ice coverage due to global warming. Greenpeace was one of three organizations that filed a lawsuit against the government. John Passacantando is the executive director of Greenpeace USA. He joins us in the studio from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, first of all, this record heat that we're experiencing in the Northeast, can you talk about the crisis of global warming now?
Well, with no particular weather event can we say this is from global warming. But what we can say from a heat wave like we're experiencing in the East is that this is exactly what the scientists have been telling us to expect from global warming. Not only increasing temperatures, but disturbed weather patterns and much warmer winters. Now, while some people have been sunbathing this weekend and enjoyed the warmer weather, most people understand that there's something very wrong with this, that this affects the size of the insect populations we're going to see in the spring. It's going to affect birds when they migrate. It's going to affect so many things. It's going to affect when water falls and when reservoirs are filled, and that throwing this kind of wrench into our climate systems is a very dangerous thing.
The polar bear. Explain what your lawsuit was about.
Well, along with the Center for Biological Diversity and the Natural Resources Defense Council, Greenpeace launched a... We proposed that the U.S. government list the polar bear as endangered or threatened under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. The Environmental Protection Agency dragged its feet on this for a full year, and didn't rule on this until the very last day when we had sued them, and they were forced to rule on this, and has now proposed that the polar bear be listed as threatened. They now have a year to come up with a management plan. The difficulty the government is in is that this is the first time the Endangered Species Act has been used to protect a critter, in this case the polar bear, from global warming. In other words, not from a localized impact of losing land to developers, for example, but in this case from losing ice pack that the polar bears need to survive in the Arctic, which was at a record level of shrinkage in 2005 and a near record in 2006. So the government, on the one hand, is saying we are going to ultimately enlist the polar bears as threatened. On the other hand, the government is speaking out of the other side of its mouth, saying we're still not sure if global warming is happening or what exactly the impacts are.
Right now, Greenpeace has experienced an IRS audit. Can you talk about what you went through and who you think was behind what happened to you?
Well, it's very clear, and it ties to the larger story about global warming. Why has the United States been so far behind the other industrialized nations in recognizing that global warming is from our emissions, CO2 emissions from burning fossil fuels, and so far behind taking actions? It comes down to a concerted effort by companies like ExxonMobil. Our records at Greenpeace show, and this is all documented on a research website called ExxonSecrets.org, that between 1998 and 2005, ExxonMobil funded groups that were going to be skeptical of global warming, in some cases lie about the truth about global warming, gave them almost $20 million to confuse the American public about global warming. Greenpeace being one of the groups that was exposing these lies, ExxonMobil, it was later found, created a small group called Public Interest Watch. Public Interest Watch, in 2004, wrote a completely erroneous report that said Greenpeace was doing illegal things with its money. This report instigated an IRS audit that Greenpeace went through for a three-month period in 2005. Greenpeace came through this audit with flying colors, but what we later learned, a Wall Street Journal reporter found that ExxonMobil funded the group that called for Greenpeace to be audited, in fact, funded the group in its entirety in the year that it published the report, 2004. So ExxonMobil has been involved in a whole array of attempts to confuse the American public and to delay any measures to put a cap on global warming pollution.
Where does the U.S. stand in relation to the rest of the world on this issue?
The U.S. stands incredibly far behind virtually every other industrialized democracy. The U.S. has essentially taken the position of ExxonMobil to the international negotiations, expressing skepticism about the science of global warming when, in fact, it is airtight. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, now with decades of research, is showing the public just exactly what is happening from global warming. So the U.S. administration, the Bush administration, has essentially run the oil industry's agenda. The analogy is to the tobacco companies. The oil companies have denied global warming as a problem, and the U.S. administration has repeated that. And now, as the evidence becomes so irrefutable, it becomes so obvious the administration is taking almost a flat Earth position, they're saying, well, we know something's happening, but we still need more evidence and more research. It's an effort to stall. And hopefully now, with more Democrats in the Congress and Democrats in the majority, they can push through this, actually have the hearings they need to have to expose this lie that was perpetrated on the American people by ExxonMobil and others through our government. Because I believe it was really one of the great corporate crimes of the late 20th and early 21st century.
John Passacontando, what about the government scientists like the NASA climate expert James Hansen, who has been talking about the squelching of government research that is taking place?
Again, this is part of the same pattern where this government, at the behest of its oil company contributors, has been told not to put out information about global warming, not to allow the scientists to talk about their expertise with the press, about the connection between global warming and hurricanes. That happened at NOAA. There's been pressure on Dr. James Hansen at NASA and others, Rick Pilkey at the Environmental Protection Agency. There have been numerous scientists who have come forward and gone public with the fact that they have been really shut down working for the government, and there are many others that we have talked to that are still afraid to come forward. So there's been a great crime has been perpetrated on the public in terms of allowing the public to know what the government scientists know about global warming.
Finally, John Pascatando, there's a website, exonsecrets.org. Can you explain how it works, what it is?
Yes. Exonsecrets.org is, at Greenpeace, we've been gathering for about 15 years everything we can find when it comes to the connection between ExxonMobil and other companies, the American Petroleum Institute, their trade association, the auto companies, funding the lies about global warming, knowing that until we pull their hands, the hands of these big corporations, off of the public policy, we're not going to get public policy that stops global warming. We'll only get policy that keeps the status quo, these guys making a lot of money selling us oil to burn. So we put all this research on a public site, exonsecrets.org, so journalists could look at this, and all our sources are there, and do their own research. Interestingly, many of our FOIAs are up there as well, showing the conversations between the Bush administration and the American Petroleum Institute, the automakers, the oil producers. And if you go to the White House website, whitehouse.gov, and under the search bar you just put in Greenpeace, you'll get a long list of all the FOIAs we did, which has a remarkable it's a remarkable library of conversations, and you'll readers will see that their government was truly in bed with the energy industry.
And the connection of the extreme weather that we've been seeing in Colorado, we talked about the Northeast being record heat, Colorado, these massive snowstorms.
Yes, and again, any one event, I can't link straight to global warming. We know that part of this is due to an El Nino event, where the parts of the Pacific are hotter than usual. This is a very old cycle, a cycle that predates human-induced global warming. Scientists are right now trying to decipher just how much El Nino is affected by global warming, if indeed there are more extreme and more frequent El Nino events from global warming. But they're not absolutely positive on that yet. What we do know is the kind of heat we're experiencing here, the kind of superstorms we saw in Katrina and Rita, the kind of raging wildfires that we've seen record numbers of in the West, all of that is exactly what the scientists have been telling us to expect from global warming.
John Pascatando, I want to thank you for being with us. Greenpeace USA is his organization. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, the controversy over the former U.S. President Jimmy Carter's book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Stay with us. John Fahey here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The controversy continues over President Jimmy Carter's recent book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. In it, the former U.S. president criticizes Israel for what he calls the continued control and colonization of Palestinian land. Carter faults Israeli settlement expansion for the failure of the peace process. He's also highly critical of the U.S. role in the Middle East, particularly its history of using veto power on the U.N. Security Council to block more than 40 U.N. resolutions critical of Israel. This is an excerpt of President Carter speaking about his book in Washington, D.C. in December.
Some people have said the title is provocative, and I accept that categorization, but I don't consider the word provocative to be a negative description, because it's designed to provoke discussion and analysis and debate in a country where debate and discussion is almost completely absent, if it involves any criticism at all of the policies of Israel. And I think the book is very balanced. Secondly, the words of Palestine, peace, not apartheid, were carefully chosen by me. First of all, it's Palestine, the area of Palestinians. It doesn't refer to Israel. I've never and would have implied that Israel is guilty of any form of apartheid in their own country, because the Arabs who live inside Israel have the same voting rights and the same citizenship rights as do the Jews who live there. And the next word is peace. And my hope is that the publication of this book will not only precipitate debate, as I've already mentioned, but also will rejuvenate an absolutely dormant or absent peace process. For the last 6 years, there's not been one single day of good faith negotiations between Israelis and their neighbors, the Palestinians. And this is absolutely a departure from what has happened under all previous presidents since Israel became a nation. We've all negotiated or attempted to negotiate peace agreements. That has been totally absent now for 6 years. So peace. And in the last two words, not apartheid. The alternative to peace is apartheid. Not inside Israel, to repeat myself, but in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, the Palestinian territory. And there, apartheid exists in its more despicable forms. The Palestinians are deprived of basic human rights. Their land has been occupied and then confiscated and then colonized by the Israeli settlers. And they have now more than 205 settlements in the West Bank itself. And what has happened is, over a period of years, the Israelis have connected settlements with highways. And those highways make the West Bank look like a honeycomb and maybe a spider web. You can envision it. And in many cases, most cases, the Palestinians are prevented from using the highways at all. And in many cases, even from crossing the highways.
Former President Jimmy Carter speaking last month in Washington, D.C. On Sunday, the New York Times published a long-awaited and largely critical review of the book written by New York Times deputy foreign editor Ethan Bronner. Bronner dismissed charges of anti-Semitism, but he characterized the book as a distortion and criticized what he called its narrow perspective. The book has seen growing media tension, which began even before its publication in early December. Leading Democrats quickly distanced themselves from Carter's book. It was immediately condemned by Jewish leaders and organizations around the country. Longtime Carter Center fellow Kenneth Stein resigned his position in protest of the book. In a letter addressed to Carter and distributed to the media, Stein accused Carter of omission, factual errors, and plagiarism. Today, we'll have a debate on the book. Joining us from Montreal is Gil Troy. He's a professor of American history at McGill University and author of Why I Am a Zionist, Israel, Jewish Identity, and the Challenges of Today. Norman Finkelstein is here with me in our Firehouse studio. He's professor of political science at DePaul University. His latest book is called Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Professor Troy. Your response to President Carter's book?
He calls his title provocative. I call it offensive. It's offensive to South Africans because, to use the term apartheid, which is about white supremacy and a systematic approach of discrimination and racism, demeans the very difficult struggle and the odious examples of South African oppression. It's also offensive to Zionists and to Jews and to anyone who supports the state of Israel, because while in his remarks that we heard, Jimmy Carter makes a distinction between what goes on inside Israel and in the territories, he did not do that in his book, which is actually quite shoddy and quite erratic. And I think, you know, it's also a disservice to the people of the world and good people who want peace, because if you want to truly be a mediator, try to find the complexity, try to show the complexity on both sides, the failures of both sides, rather than having this one-sided approach which basically throws water on any hopes for peace and actually throws gasoline on the fires of the Middle East.
Professor Finkelstein.
Well, the question, it seems to me, is whether or not the term apartheid is appropriate in this context. I'm not going to, for the moment, I'm not going to make an argument either way. The question I would raise is, if the term is, as it's often been said recently, if the term is anti-Semitic or contrary to the interests of Jews, however you want to put it, how do you account for the fact that so many mainstream figures and organizations in Israeli life themselves use the term apartheid to characterize the Israeli occupation, the West Bank and Gaza? You take the case of B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. In May 2002, they put out a report entitled Land Grab. It's a substantial report. It's not throwing around slogans and terms. The report's about 150 pages based on quite in-depth research. They conclude in their report that Israel has established a regime in occupied territories, which is, as they put it, reminiscent of the South African apartheid regime. This past year, B'Tselem put out another report entitled Forbidden Roads on the what they call the road regime in the occupied territories. Again, they concluded that this is reminiscent of the apartheid regime in South Africa. You take the case of Haaretz, Israel's leading newspaper or most influential newspaper. And in their editorials, they routinely refer to the apartheid-like regime in the occupied territories. So for the moment, I would like to focus on the question, why is it illegitimate to use the term? Why is it anti-Semitic to use the term here? Whereas in Israel, just yesterday, Shulamith Aloni, the former cabinet minister for education under Rabin, she says, everybody here knows it's apartheid. So why is it illegitimate for a former American president to use a term which is a commonplace? I'm not saying everyone agrees it's apartheid in Israel, but it's certainly part of the mainstream discourse. Why are you in the United States disqualified from participating in what in Israel is part of the mainstream discourse?
Professor Chirai.
First of all, I didn't accuse the former president of anti-Semitism. I didn't accuse him of not having the qualifications to jump into the debate. I think the term is historically offensive and inaccurate. I said it's offensive to South Africans. I said it's offensive to people who want peace in the Middle East. Just because there are many Israeli leftists and many Israeli critics of Israeli policy who use the term doesn't mean that it's a legitimate term. As a historian, I can say it's a false historical analogy. What I learned from that is that in the United States and in Israel, unlike the country that Jimmy Carter pretends to live in, there is a vigorous debate on the Israeli side. There is a vigorous debate on the American side. There isn't a vigorous debate on the Palestinian side, which doesn't have the same kind of political culture. It actually has a toxic political culture, where right now we've seen over 500 Palestinians killing each other in an internecine civil war. So I'd like to focus on the question that has been sidestepped of, is it an accurate and is it a helpful term? And I say it's not, because let's look at what apartheid was. Apartheid was a regime started in the South Africans in the 1940s as an attempt, and it started actually with a kind of sexual revulsion on the part of whites against blacks, to truly degrade blacks. And the community of nations, it took them decades, but the community of nations justifiably said, this is so odious that we want to kind of vomit out, and I use that term advisedly, vomit out South Africa from the community of nations because they're so despicable. When Israelis use the term, they're being provocative, and they're being incendiary, they're being inaccurate. When the former president of the United States, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, uses the term, it's even more destructive, because what he's doing is he's giving it a kind of legitimacy to a Zionist movement which has already been libeled as being racist. And it feeds, and I see it on campus, where there's quite a vigorous criticism of Israel every day. They use the term Israel apartheid, and they don't distinguish between the territories and Israel. They look at it as an illegitimate country, and Jimmy Carter, who has shown a capacity for friendship of all kinds of dictators, from North Korea to China to Cuba, all of a sudden seems to have quite a harsh perspective when it comes to Israel, and I wonder why.
Norman Finkelstein.
I agree that we shouldn't fixate on terms. We should look beneath the terms and see whether they accurately represent the reality. And that's what I think those who have used that term have tried to do. So you take the case of B'Tselem. It publishes a report, and it says Israel has constructed in the occupied territories what it calls a roads regime with roads for Jews only. They go on to say that Israel is...
Explain that. What do you mean?
Well, there are roads which connect the settlements in the occupied territories with Israel. And those roads, there's various kinds of laws and various degrees. It's a complex system. But those laws effectively mean that Jews are the only ones who are allowed to use these roads connecting the occupied territories to Israel. And Palestinians have to take these circuitous routes in order to get from one part of the occupied territories to another. In 2002, the B'Tselem report points to the fact that the kinds of settlements and the kinds of laws in the occupied territories resemble the apartheid system in that there's a different system of laws for Palestinians and there's a different system of laws for Israelis. So it's not so important, in my opinion, to fixate on the term. I agree. It can become sloganeering, but we should look at the policies. We should look at what's going on. Jimmy Carter has, in my opinion, a compelling section of the book. It's chapter 16, which I would encourage your listeners to look at, where it's entitled The Wall as a Prison. And in chapter 16, he goes through the wall that Israel is building in the occupied territories. Now, I want to emphasize, because there's so much misinformation on this topic in the United States, I suspect that Professor Troy is going to immediately jump in and say it's not a wall, just as Ethan Bronner, the deputy foreign editor of the New York Times, notes parenthetically that the edifice that Israel is building is only 4% a wall. Well, these issues have been resolved legally. The International Court of Justice in July 2004, when it adjudicated the question of the wall that Israel is building in the occupied territories, at the very beginning it says there has been some dispute about the language used. Should we call it a fence? Should we call it a barrier? Should we call it a wall? And the International Court of Justice, going through all the possibilities, exploring the linguistic resonances of all the terms, it concludes we should call it a wall. When Jimmy Carter uses that term, he is using the term which has been agreed to by consensus in the International Court of Justice. And I should add that Human Rights Watch, a mainstream human rights organization, in its publications and in accordance with international law and the International Court of Justice, uses the term wall. And Jimmy Carter says, what's happening in the occupied territories is Israel's confiscating about 10% of Palestinian land inside the wall. And he says, I thought it was a compelling point, he says Israel will not only control all the Palestinians within the wall, but Israel has de facto also annexed the Jordan Valley, which means all the Palestinians between the Jordan Valley and the wall will also be controlled by Israel. They are creating, and Jimmy Carter, I think, with a certain amount of candor, he said, I don't think it should be called a separation fence. I think it should be called an imprisonment wall. I think that's accurate.
Professor Troy.
I would actually have less of a problem if he called it an imprisonment wall. We could debate wall fence, but that actually is not my point. The reason why apartheid is so problematic is because it feeds a broad campaign to delegitimize Israel, to expel it from the United Nations, to make it an outlaw state, when it's a democracy and a flawed democracy, like America's a flawed democracy, like all countries are flawed. I'm not going to focus on the question of Walworth's friends. I'm going to use the T word, terrorism. It's not as if, unlike in South Africa, Israel one day woke up and said, boy, how can we torture the Palestinians? Although if you read Jimmy Carter's book, you'd get that impression, because he doesn't give a full and honest and balanced accounting of the Israeli side of the ledger. What happened was that there was this Oslo peace process, which he also tends to give short shrift to. And as a result of that Oslo peace process, there was a very generous Israeli offer made at Camp David, which Jimmy Carter also tends to skip over. And then in September 2000, the Palestinians launched an approach with lots of terrorism. Yasser Arafat, and there's proof that Yasser Arafat helped underwrite the terrorism, although Jimmy Carter ignores that in the book because he was good friends with Yasser Arafat. And the terrorism was the issue. Both the Israeli left and the Israeli right initially hated the idea of any kind of wall fence barrier, because the Israeli right wanted to incorporate the territories into Israel. The Israeli left wanted to have this vision of everyone living together in what I would love to see, in beautiful peace and harmony. Both of them had to kind of be forced by serious suicide bombings, by a systematic terrorist campaign, by a political culture on the part of the Palestinians that was anti-Semitic. That is anti-Semitic, not Jimmy Carter. That in the Palestinian mosques, on Palestinian television, was attacking not just Zionists, but Jews, and attacking the West, and celebrating 9/11, and was part of a broader Islamicist surge against the United States, against Israel, against the West, that led to hundreds of deaths of children, of men, of women. That is the context in which the wall, fence, barrier was built, and that is the context in which these last couple of years, the 6 years of a lack of peace process, has occurred. And without acknowledgement of that, Jimmy Carter at one point says there are two problems in the Middle East. The first is that some Israelis want to grab land, and second is that some Palestinians react to that with violence. And that's very disingenuous. The problem, let's have someone stand up and say, it's a messy situation. There are rights and wrongs on both sides. I would have been so much happier with the book if he had said, the problem is, yes, some Israelis want Palestinian land, and there's a complicated historical, legal, strategic debate over that. And two, there are Palestinians who want to destroy the Jewish state. How do we get out of that tension? Until we acknowledge the problems on both sides, the weaknesses on both sides, the failures on both sides, we're not going to get to the peace that Jimmy Carter claims to achieve. And I think what he's done is he's undermined his status as a mediator, as an honest broker, by using this incendiary term and by coming out with a book which, frankly, is shoddy. He tends to quote Arafat rather than quoting Palestinian Hamas documents. He quotes Assad, the president of Syria, allowing him to kind of give a spin on events rather than giving facts. And that's the problem with this propagandistic work.
Well, Gil Troy and Norman Finkelstein, we're going to come back to this debate on Jimmy Carter's book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, in a minute.
Would you have a pen? Thank you.
Cloudy Day by John Fahey here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're having a debate on Jimmy Carter's book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, with Gil Troy, professor of American history at McGill University in Montreal. Among his books, Why I Am a Zionist, Israel-Jewish Identity, and the Challenges of Today, Norman Finkelstein joins us here in our New York Firehouse studio. He's a professor of political science at DePaul University in Chicago. His latest book is Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history. In Ethan Bronner's review, long-awaited, that came out yesterday in the New York Times book review, he says this book has something of a Rip Van Winkle feel to it, as if little had changed since Carter diagnosed the problem in the 70s. All would be well today, he suggests, if his advice then had been followed. Forget al-Qaeda. The name does not appear in this book. The nuclear ambitions of Iran and the rise of Taliban in Afghanistan. If Israel had, quote, refrained from colonizing the West Bank, he asserts, there would have been a comprehensive and lasting peace. Bronner's talking about Carter, of course. And he goes on to say the debate about the Israeli occupation, quote, will shape the future of Israel. It may also determine the prospects of for peace in the Middle East and perhaps the world, quoting Jimmy Carter. And Bronner says this is an awfully narrow perspective. Before I get your response, Professor Finkelstein, I wanted to go for a minute to Brent Scowcroft. He was speaking yesterday on This Week with George Stephanopoulos. Stephanopoulos had asked him about the significance of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Of course, Brent Scowcroft is the former National Security Advisor for President Bush Sr.
What it would do is change the psychological climate of the region. What we have is a number of different issues all coming together. And the region is in great turmoil. And there's a great sense in the region of historical injustice on the part of the Muslims. And this would change that. This would see us as participating and helping in a problem which is central to the region, which has been a gnawing sore for Muslims for 50 years.
That was President Bush Sr.'s former National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General Brent Scowcroft. Professor Finkelstein.
I'll get to that point in half a moment. Let me just address the questions that were raised by Professor Troy. On the question of Camp David and the offer, I don't think for Democracy Now! Audiences we have to go over that ground, because when Shlomo Ben-Ami was here,
The former foreign minister of Israel
and one of the main negotiators at Camp David, he said, frankly, were I a Palestinian, I would not have accepted the offer at Camp David, and exactly for the reasons that Carter outlines in the book, namely, Palestinians were asked to make such monumental concessions that no Palestinian leader could, in good conscience, let alone as a representative of the Palestinians, accept such an offer. That was the position of Arafat. It's also the position to which Shlomo Ben-Ami agreed. On the question of terrorism, as Professor Troy calls it, the big T word, I think there's a certain confusion about what was the sequence of events. The Second Intifada begins September 28, 2000. Between September 28, 2000 and March 2003, there wasn't one Palestinian terrorist attack. The suicide bombings began 5 months after the beginning of the Second Intifada. Why did it begin? Well, the first month of the Intifada, the ratio of Palestinians to Israelis killed was 20 to 1. And if you read Shlomo Ben-Ami's book, he states there that had Israel not so overreacted to the Palestinian protests, which were overwhelmingly nonviolent in the first months, the huge explosion that subsequently occurred probably would not have happened. But those first 5 months, when Israel was killing 20 times as many Palestinians, overwhelmingly nonviolent protesters, to each Israeli killed, that part has been completely effaced from the historical record. Now, it's true, suicide bombings began. And one possible way to avert them, not the only one, but one possibility, was to build a wall. Well, but there's an option. If you want to prevent suicide bombings against your country, just like if you want to prevent a neighbor from intruding on your property, you build a fence or a wall, but you build it along the border, the internationally recognized border. Israel didn't do that. it used the suicide bombings as a pretext to confiscate 10% of Palestinian land. If they wanted to build a wall on their border, the International Court said, that's not a problem. What they said was, the International Court of Justice, when it condemned the wall, it said this wall is taking a sinuous path, which is incorporating the Israeli settlements. That's what made the wall illegal. Now, Professor Troy says he would prefer if coverage of the Israel-Palestine conflict by Carter and others would assign responsibility to both sides. But the problem is, if you look at the international consensus for resolving the conflict, the burden of responsibility for the failure to resolve the conflict falls on the side of Israel and the United States. Carter is very clear in that, in my opinion, entirely accurate. He says the main problem is Israel refuses to recognize international law. The law is absolutely clear. It's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. Israel acquired the West Bank and Gaza in the course of the 1967 war. The International Court of Justice said, under the UN Charter, Article 2, it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. Israel has to withdraw to its internationally recognized June 67 borders. It refuses. That's the obstacle. A simple illustration. Every year, the United Nations General Assembly votes on a resolution entitled Peaceful Resolution of the Palestine Conflict. Every year, the vote is the same. The whole world on one side, the whole world on one side, and on the other side, the United States, Israel, and usually Palau, Nauru, Tuvalu, the Marshall Islands, and Micronesia. It's usually 6 dissenting votes. And that's it. The problem that I think is not that the world is, not that the coverage is biased. The problem is the reality is biased. I was reading a book today, to get to your last point you mentioned, by Ze'ev Ma'oz, a mainstream Israeli military historian, smart fellow, and it's a good book, and called Defending the Holy State. He says, in 100 years from now, people are going to be very perplexed by this conflict. He said, because he says, compared to other conflicts, this is not a particularly complicated one. And it really isn't. There has been a resolution, a settlement on the table for 30 years. And Israel and the United States have blocked it. That's the problem. And Carter, to his credit, forthrightly says it. One side is blocking the settlement.
I wanted to get back to Professor Troy. Israel has announced that it's going to now build new settlements in the West Bank. Do you think peace is possible with continued settlements there?
I think peace is possible with a recognition of the pain on both sides and with serious attempts at compromise. We historians like to say that what's your favorite text? Context. To claim, for example, that suicide bombings started in 2003 when they actually started by Hamas and others during the Oslo peace process. In the 1990s, there were suicide bombings in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem. It's a much more complicated story. When I look at all conflicts in history, it's so easy to caricature. It's so easy to say, oh, the Israelis are the bad guys. And to rely on the United Nations as an honest broker in this is highly problematic, given that it's the same United Nations that has been so biased against Israel that had a big attempt to revitalize its ugly Zionism as racism slur from the 1970s in the early 2000 period. So I'd rather say this. Israel has tried, it's a complicated situation. Israel and the Palestinians are in many ways intertwined with each other. There's an intimacy between many Israelis and Palestinians that we don't see when we sit here in television studios and debate what's going on. And there's also obviously a lot of hatred. There's extremism on the Palestinian side. There's, as I said, a political culture which is highly problematic and truly vicious and ugly, where they kill each other as well as Jews and celebrate those deaths. So how do you break out of that? Israel has tried. Israel tried satisfied with the Oslo peace process for all its flawed. And that, by the way, to go to General Scowcroft's point, in the 1990s, Bill Clinton was spending a lot of time. Yasser Arafat was supposedly the most welcomed foreign guest, the foreign guest who had the most visits to the Clinton White House. America put tremendous prestige on the line to try to get this so-called simple solution. And it fell apart. It fell apart because of failures on both sides. Let's acknowledge that, rather than saying one side is the bad guy, one side is the good guy. And to claim, and that, of course, during the 1990s was the period that al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden were issuing their fatwas, not so much about Jews and Palestinians and Zionists and Israel, but about American troops in Saudi Arabia and about this broader desire to undo the great historical crime of Spain getting rid of the Muslims 500 years ago. I mean, there are much more complicated and bigger issues going on. And to reduce everything, as Jimmy Carter does, to reduce everything, as part of this conversation is doing, to this unidimensional perspective that if Israelis stopped building settlements, then, you know, somehow peace would reign in the land and peace would reign in the world, it's just not true. Israel tried, let's say, in Gaza in 2005 with its disengagement by pulling back. This was an opportunity for the Palestinians. This was a test for the Palestinians. I've been to Gaza, and I've seen the beautiful beachfronts they have. And obviously, there are a lot of problems in Gaza. There was no attempt at development. American Jewish philanthropists raised $14 million to buy out Israeli agricultural initiatives and pass it over to the Palestinians. Those farms were trashed. There were attempts. There have been attempts. Israelis don't trust. They don't trust because the United Nations gangs up on them. They don't trust because the International Court passes its decision on the fence wall barrier without talking about terrorism.
Professor Troy, we only have 2 minutes, and I wanted to ask each of you the issue of having this debate at all in this country. Professor Carter was invited to speak at President Carter was invited to speak at Brandeis University. Then the invitation was withdrawn unless he agreed to have a debate with Alan Dershowitz. Your book, Beyond Chutzpah, Professor Finkelstein, is also very much about what Dershowitz has to say about Israel and his book, The Case for Peace. Your response on this issue?
I think that's an important question, maybe the most important, how to normalize debate in the United States about this topic. I don't mean that everybody has to agree with me. The question is, how do you open up a forum so people can exchange reviews on the topic? I'll quickly give you three examples or a couple of examples.
We have 1 minute.
Yeah. Take the example, a couple of weeks ago, Anderson Cooper's producer called me. So they want to do a segment on me having to do with the Middle East because he was in the Arab world. I said, don't waste your time. It's never going to get on the air. I know how it works. They said, no, we're sending down a camera crew. They sent down a camera crew, sent down the producer, interviewed me for 2.5 hours from 10 a.m. till 12:30. I said, it's never going to get on. I know. Well, she said, no, we invested the money. Long story short, it was killed. It was supposed to be on that night. Take the case of Carter. Okay, a serious debate. But why is it Brandeis University has half a dozen centers for the study of the Middle East, Arab-Israeli conflict, and so forth? Yehuda Reinhartz himself is a historian on Zionism. I've read his biography of Weizmann. Why is it, of all the qualified people they could have drawn on to debate Jimmy Carter, they bring a clown from Harvard? It's just not serious.
Professor Troy, 10 seconds on the issue of a debate.
Both sides feel that they're not being heard. That means that actually both sides are, to a certain extent, being heard.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I encourage people to email us at mail@democracynow.org to talk about your thoughts and what you would like to see pursued. That's mail@democracynow.org. Professor Finkelstein of DePaul University, his book is called Beyond Chutzpah. Professor Gil Troy of American History at McGill University in Montreal, thank you for joining us. His book
thank
is
you.
Called Why I'm a Zionist, Israel-Jewish Identity and the Challenges of Today. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Matei, Lee Burek, Jen Yutz, and Nagera. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nagera are our engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin, Megan Whitney, Angela Alston, Eric Galed, Jerome Bourgeois, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Peter Hewn, Samantha Chamblee, Hugh Grant. I'm Amy Goodman, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.